ever warrant the arrest for the murder of William Little, who was the gas station attendant?
But you're wrong.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 7, Episode 6. In this episode, we heard, what I consider to be a pretty confusing string of stories or recalling of events from Danny Hartley and Dion Rhodes, stories that change from one interview to the next, and between the two of them, it's left us all with a lot of questions. I'm joined today by Mike Bussing.
Hello.
And Zach Weaver.
Aloha.
So we're going to get right into your questions, but real quick, I'll give you guys a little bit of an update on the studio progress, because a lot of people have been asking. We are, I think, days away from at least having a recording booth ready. Zach was here last weekend, and we spent some time in the attic, ran a bunch of wires, and then Mike and I on Monday spent all day building and insulating and putting the wall material up in the studio. We got the air conditioning unit in there, so hopefully by next week, we will be recording in our actual soundproof, sound-treated studio instead of the garage.
I am definitely looking forward to that.
I know this is getting a little bit old, but we're still getting it done. So speaking of which, let's go ahead and get started.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we've got a couple questions here from listener Elizabeth. She says, are there any phone and or bank records still around that would tell us more about who Mr. Little spent time with, other than those we already know, and where he spent his money? It would be helpful to have an idea of how much he made at the gas station, how much he generally worked, what his expenses were, and how often and how much he was gambling.
Well, of all those questions, the only thing that I can give you a pretty solid answer on is how much he worked. There's a report in there where I think it was his mother said that Bill had told her that he wanted to find a full-time job. So I know he wasn't working full-time hours at the Clark station. Other than that, as far as the rest of that goes, we don't have that information. And it's another indication that the original investigators didn't have a real focus on victimology. Now, mind you, in 91, the forensics were different. The technology was different out there. But like, I haven't seen anywhere in any of the reports where phone numbers were listed, where bank records were pulled. These are all things that should be done for victimology. You're trying to identify and find those risk factors. And those are really good questions, because that's what the investigators should have done. And I don't want to put that on them that they should have done that. I think we know more now than they knew in 91. But pulling bank records and interviewing more people about Bill, I think, would have given us a little more insight. I know that his time at the Leroy Pool Hall, where he was playing pool and poker, that seemed to be a regular occurrence. I've came across several police reports where people have mentioned that he was there. Most of them said that he was never in much debt. Like he would usually bet like $20 at a time. But we don't have the phone numbers. We don't have call records. We don't have any of that stuff. And I know that was available, or it's possible to get that. I guess I don't. Now that I'm thinking, I was thinking from Ed Eight's case. Mm-hmm. We had all those phone records that were very helpful and figuring out what Elnor Griffin was doing in season 2, but that was 93, but it's got to be the same technology in 91.
Yeah, pretty close to it at least.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of technology in 1991, boy, was I wrong about the ATMs.
Yeah, that's partially my fault, I think.
Yeah, well, I just really didn't, I mean, I guess I wasn't, I wasn't old enough to have an ATM card in 1991. But that just seemed like, as I told the story last week about my aunt with the debit card when that came out, but there were several people immediately on all forms of social media were like sharing articles with us that were like, nope, they were around in the 80s.
Yeah, we were pretty floored because we looked it up when we got done. We looked it up on Google when we got done, and
We were pretty floored that it, when it said it, they started, because I wouldn't have guessed that.
It seemed like some technology you wouldn't have expected that early.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I think it said that the first ATM came out in like 1969.
Yeah, and then they got to be more common in the early 80s, and they were really mainstream by mid-80s. They were definitely around back then. It just, I guess because, you know, it's all data signal being transferred, right? Like, every once in a while, even now today, if you go into like an old gas station or something and use it, you'll actually hear, it sounds like the old AOL dial-up modem. You'll hear, and then connect and give your money. It just didn't seem like that was something around back then. But to be clear, yes, ATMs were a thing. However, that doesn't get us much closer to knowing much about this, because there's no records of them, of whether or not there was an ATM at that credit union, if there was a surveillance video, or if the police tried to procure that surveillance video, if there was one. I have a hunch, probably. I'm going to stop hunching and probablying, because I was dead wrong last week. But I mean, back then it wouldn't have been like a digital recording like you had later. You're probably talking about actual, like, reel to reel or VHS tapes, if there was a surveillance system in there. So I doubt that was a thing, or I have to believe that the police would have.
Yeah, and you got to believe that resolution has got to be poor too at that time frame.
They didn't have 4K.
They didn't have 4K.
Least, I'm going to go out on a limb.
At least in my
I'm going to go out on a limb and say there was not 4K digital recorders in 1991.
Yeah, I mean, just look at some of the old surveillance stuff. There's a person there, yes.
Right, but it's super grainy.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was well over 200 feet away where the actual credit union building was from the gas station. So yeah, I doubt it would have been of any use if there was one.
All right. Next, she says, there appears to have been a tremendous amount of gang activity in this town in the early 90s. Was this gas station located in an area claimed by any particular gang as their, quote, territory?
Well, I don't know. There's nothing really in any of the police files that I've seen so far. And I went through Tuesday, yesterday. I just said no construction. I'm 100% focusing on research and getting ready for this week's episode. And I read hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents yesterday, and there's nothing in there about whether it be the Northsiders or any other type of gang in the police files. I did see that a lot of listeners on the fan page have done some research, and there were some gang problems in the Bloomington Normal area back then. But I just can't see it being the types of gang problems you see in areas where we've worked, like Dallas and Houston, and, you know, where you've got big gangs.
Now, I can't remember where we heard this. I mean, we've been getting information from so many sources, but it sounded to me like the gangs that were in the area were affiliated or like branches of some of the bigger gangs out of Chicago.
Right. Yeah. And we heard that when because you and I had a discussion last week about Drew, the guy we interviewed last week that mentioned the Gaylords gang. And you heard me. I thought he was, because he had called the Northsiders the gay prison gang.
Yeah.
Kind of jokingly. So I thought he was joking again. I didn't realize, and you knew, Mike, because you have a friend that actually works in the Cook County Jail in Chicago. Yeah. That's a real gang, a spinoff of the Latin Kings, was it?
Right. Yep.
Yeah. So that's what it sounds like. The gangs that might have been present in Bloomington at the time were feeding down from the Chicago area, which is about 2 hours away.
Yeah, and didn't Drew mention something about how when those gangs moved into the area, there was a massive push by law enforcement to get them out, and they didn't last very long in Bloomington?
Well, what I'm wondering is if it was law enforcement or other gangs. Now, seeing some of these articles that people have shared, it does seem like there was some gang activity in Bloomington at the time. And because all he said was, I think his exact quote was, that shit got squashed real fast, like within 2 months when the Northsiders tried to move out onto the streets of Bloomington. I don't think the way most gangs typically work, that law enforcement has the ability to push them out that quick or put a stop to it. But I think what can happen is other gangs, like, that's their territory, that's their turf, that aren't going to put up with that when another gang comes in.
Yeah, they won't put up with it at
all. Yeah, so I have a hunch. The impression that I got from Drew was more that it was the other gangs that squashed that and didn't let the Northsiders come into town. But as far as the meat of that question, could it have been another rival gang's territory? I don't think so. First of all, I don't think this profiles as a gang-related issue in general. I mean, it just doesn't. It looks like, I agree with Jim Clementi, this looks like a personal cause homicide. This was somebody who had a problem with Bill, probably specifically. And then also in reading a lot of the reports and talking to some people, That was a quiet area. Like Gina Luna, who was the attendant that was supposed to be working that night that spoke with Tammy at the fair a couple weeks ago, said that it was that station was quiet always. It was one of those the corner gas stations. It was mostly regulars. There weren't a lot of out-of-town people. And Mike, we've been there, that area. It's not like you're right off the highway because there are major highways that go through there, but they're miles away and there's gas stations right there at the exit. There's no reason for a transient moving, whether it be a truck driver or whoever, moving through that area to go 5 miles off the highway through town through a million stoplights to go to this tiny little gas station.
Yeah, it sounds like more like a neighborhood gas station.
That's how she described it, right, is that it was just a neighborhood, a lot of regulars. And you see in the, some of those, you know, Martinez said, you know, he knew the attendant. He said he usually had a guy that was in there when he closed, who would be Danny Hartley. Gutierrez said that when he went in to pay for his gas, that the attendant wasn't very talkative like he usually is. Like so I think the attendants and the customers, for the most part, knew each other.
Yeah,
and so I don't think the gang issue plays necessarily as far as like it being someone else's turf.
So speaking of the Drew guy, that's a interesting fellow.
Oh yeah, he is.
Yeah, I want to hear more from that guy.
Yeah, I talked to him for quite a while, but some of the stuff we talked about was off the record.
Yeah.
just in general. But yeah, he's a super interesting guy. He spent some time in and out of prisons. He's a smart guy.
Yeah,
knows the area and the people really well. And yeah, we'll probably hear more from him later because some of the stuff we talked about is just stuff that we haven't gotten into yet, which we're going to be getting into very soon. Like when we start getting into Jamie Snow, who was convicted of this, which is going to be happening this weekend when we're going to start getting into that. But yeah, he's a very interesting guy.
All right, this next one's from Jennifer. She says, so far it sounds like the majority of the evidence in this case is witness testimony, which can be very unreliable. What would you say the biggest pieces of physical evidence are? Which, if any, witnesses' statements we heard about in the first 6 episodes can be corroborated by physical evidence?
Well, that's the problem with this case, is there really isn't any. I mean, there is some forensic evidence that was analyzed by the police. There was a footprint or a shoe impression that was pulled from the store, and they found some fingerprints. But you're talking about a public gas station that people are in and out of all the time. So there was nothing connecting. There was no piece of physical evidence in 1991 that could connect the killer to the victim in this case, to the actual crime. Now, there's possibilities of that now in 2019 because there's a lot, you know. So back then, for DNA, they're looking for blood or semen to try to pull DNA. DNA was a new technology. Now we have MVAC technology and touch DNA, and you can pull skin cells, you know. So I think there's a potential. I'm hoping that we can maybe use MVAC technology on Bill Little's clothing, because even though there's no signs of a struggle, I find it hard to believe that somebody wouldn't at least be at some point grabbing him, grabbing a shirt, holding him. You know, maybe when Gutierrez comes in, getting home, saying, you know, don't you say anything. And like, with new technology, that's enough.
So what's the MVAC technology?
MVAC technology is a collection method to get DNA. It's not a testing method. So typically to get touch DNA, you use what looks like a Q-tip. That's just a cotton swab.
Okay.
They put a sterile solution on it. They wipe it over an area, and then they cut the cotton off and they run it through whatever they run it through to pull DNA out of it. So if I grab, say, Mike's shirt, Mike's a victim somewhere, you can only do it, and it costs a lot of money for every one of those little Q-tips, right? So they got to pick a few spots. We did it in Kiao Gove's case in season 3. That normal DNA testing method, we had to pick which spots do we think we might have found the perp's DNA on to send it in. MVAC can test the whole shirt, and it's literally like a wet vac. So it takes that same sterile solution and it sprays it on all over, say, a shirt with high pressure, and it just jars loose, gets stuff that's down in the fibers, everything, and then it's got like a vacuum, an actual vacuum that sucks that back out of it. So you can just take it and work it over the entire shirt, and it pulls it through a filter. Like a little disc instead of a swab, there's a cotton disc that's a filter that takes all that sterile solution that you pulled off the shirt and suck it through it. And then you take that disc and then you cut that into pieces and run it through the centrifuge. And it can get hundreds, I think generally 200 times the amount of DNA from an item than a traditional swabbing method.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. So it was something where like a shirt in 1991 was completely useless if it didn't have blood or something on it. Whereas now that same shirt could render some results that could find some answers. But there wasn't a lot of forensic evidence to work with back in 1991. They collected some stuff, but there wasn't a lot that could be done with it. But getting back to the eyewitnessing, and that's the problem. And honestly, the more and more I look, and we're going to talk about this a little more on Sunday, Jamie Snow said this to me the first time I talked to him, that the biggest mistake they made in this case was releasing that composite sketch. And it didn't make sense to me at the time. It's starting to make sense to me now. Because, and to be clear, Jamie Snow looks nothing like that composite sketch. He's not saying that they drew a sketch that looked like him. It's what he's saying is that composite sketch caused people to be looking for people that looked like that guy. And that was it. It's eyewitness identification. It may not be right. And I find myself wondering, was Gutierrez the scar on the chin and the earring? But remember, we talked about how detailed his description was.
Yeah.
And we talked, could he have been law enforcement or military? Like, how did he give such a detailed description? And it makes me wonder, maybe he was wrong about that stuff. What if he was wrong and the guy had a hair sitting on his chin that he thought was a scar? There's people in these reports I'm seeing that were cleared because they didn't have a scar on their chin, that they had leads that were indicating this person could be the person that killed Bill, but his ear wasn't pierced or he didn't have a scar on his chin. So therefore, it couldn't have been him. And who's to say that Gutierrez isn't wrong?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Or that, you know, Martinez isn't wrong, you know, because we're also assuming that it was the same guy that Gutierrez saw in Martinez. Because, and I still believe that, I mean, the odds of someone with the same build, wearing the same clothes, coming out of the same store 15 minutes apart seems unlikely that it was someone else. But what if it was? That changes a lot of things.
Yeah.
If it was, you know, everything from our victimology. And then you have our profile of the case, because we're assuming this person was in there that whole time. But then you have Martinez, who later did a composite, which we're going to get into Sunday, that doesn't look anything like Gutierrez's.
Yeah.
But then they both picked the same guy out of the lineup. So much of this case was involving eyewitness identification. Gutierrez, to me, should have been the only one who we could really rely on because he was face-to-face with the guy. Martinez is in the dark in a gas station, sees a guy in a couple seconds, flash walk around the corner. The Luna boys are over 200 feet away at night in the gas station. Gutierrez was face-to-face if that was the right guy. But we got to go back to what we've said many, many, many times before. Eyewitness identification is the weakest form of evidence in any case.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, in this case, that's what the police relied on.
You know, it's hard to say that it couldn't be two different people, because look at you and I. You know, we just posted a photo on the fans page and people stated how many times we looked alike.
Right. And we really don't look anything alike.
We really don't look anything alike.
But we both have beards. We're both about the same build. We both have tattoos.
Yeah. So you leave a gas station. I come in 10 minutes later and leave the gas station.
Right. And for that matter, you're wearing right now your Bridgman baseball hat from coaching. I have the exact same hat because we coach together.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it could be very easy for the two of us to walk in and out and people say, yeah, it was the same guy.
Yeah.
More to that point, they put out a composite sketch. Let's say it was you that was in there and committed a burglary or robbery or murder even. And so they make a composite sketch of you, and the guy is about 6'1". About 250 pounds. I'm probably doing myself a favor and adding some weight to you. wearing a ball cap with a beard, and they draw this composite, and his arms are covered in tattoos, and they put this composite sketch up, and then I come home, and my wife's like, what the hell? They just described you.
Yeah.
And so we're probably 100 other people's, you know, wives when they come home, or friends or kids, you know, that you look like this person. So It's a pretty weak form of evidence, and that's why we just got to keep digging deeper and hopefully get some new forensic testing done and find not eyewitnesses, but witnesses in the fact that have some knowledge from people talking about it.
Sounds almost worse than eyewitnesses.
Right. You're not wrong. Like
some hearsay telephone stuff again.
Right. But, yeah. Well, and that's funny you said that, because that's a big part of what Sunday's episode is about, because it is worse in some cases.
All right. Next, we got one from Richard. What car did Danny Hartley drive back then? I'm wondering if it might be the same type of car that a witness said they saw behind the gas station at around 8:15 p.m.
All of the vehicles that were mentioned that I've seen in the police reports were all either brown or tan. And I don't know if they're the same vehicles. You know, there was the one that I think Mr. Brown saw around on East Holm. Somebody saw a brown or tan vehicle parked beside the station, one out at the pump, one in the alley. I don't know if they're all describing the same vehicle. But Danny Hartley was driving his mom's gray or silver Honda Civic, according to both him and Dion. They both described that. But interestingly, remember in our first trip to Bloomington, we were listening to a lot of the recorded tapes, And we listened to a guy, Jacob, who you all heard from in episode one, Bill's good friend from high school. And he, in another interview he had given, and he was talking about how Danny Hartley was driving Bill's, was it a Ranchero?
El Camino.
It's not an El Camino. It's like an El Camino. Okay,
because I heard that several times that they said El Camino.
So. Yeah, it was. I think it's called a Ranchero, Ford Ranchero. I could that have it wrong. Right. But whatever, it was Ford's version of the El Camino. And Jacob was saying, you know, why he was driving his car that night. I don't know where he heard that, but it doesn't seem to be the case because there's interviews with Bill's dad, Ronnie Little, with the police where he said that he had stopped insuring the car because Bill got a ticket or something. And so the insurance got too high. So he stopped insuring it and he wasn't driving it anymore. But what I haven't seen is how the hell Bill got to work then.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen the crime scene photos. Bill's Ranchero is not in the parking lot anywhere.
No.
So I'm curious to this day how Bill got to work because he apparently wasn't driving his car. His dad said his car was parked at his house. There were no other cars parked outside that Bill was driving. So I don't know, maybe his dad gave him a ride in and then Danny was going to give him a ride home. I don't know.
Fiona writes, why were the police so interested in what shoes Dion and Danny were wearing? Did they have footprint evidence?
So there is, yes. And I've just started going through that. I found the file with all of the back and forth with police and the forensic laboratories. Remember in episode two, I think it was, where we talked about they were doing the electrostatic lifts on the floor, the crime scene techs were.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I still don't exactly have an understanding of what that is. I don't know if it's a film they put over. I know they use like static electricity and it pulls dust up to make prints somehow or another.
Hmm.
But they did find a couple of footprints and they're pretty, we were just looking at them before we recorded. They're pretty clear, and it actually seems like they know what type of shoe they came from, but I don't know what was done with that. So I don't know who, but that's why they were collecting everyone's shoes to compare them to those prints. And the information is in there. I just haven't gotten deep into it enough to know whose shoes all were compared. But I know Dion and Danny, and it seems like everyone they talked to, they pulled their shoes to compare to those prints. And they're not like a police uniform shoe or boot. It looks like a tennis shoe, like a Converse tennis shoe, actually. Yeah.
All right, next, Sandy says, do you think that Danny's story may have changed because there were drugs involved?
I don't know. Zach, we haven't talked about this because you just got here.
Mm-hmm.
What were your thoughts about the changing stories? What do you think?
You know, to me, there is time elapsed in these stories. So it could just be your memory making things up. Or it could be that something happened that they're trying to not get in trouble for that's minute. That at the time, it didn't feel like it was a big deal. Kind of like season two with Ed Eights,
mm-hmm.
where he didn't want to get in trouble with his mom for taking the car.
And so he told a little lie.
So he told a little lie and it turns into a big thing.
Right.
And maybe that's kind of the same thing. Maybe it was something silly that happened that...
I'm glad you said that because I kind of feel the same way. I do not think, I will go on record saying, based on what I've seen so far, I do not think Danny Hartley has anything to do with Bill's murder, nor does Dion Rhodes. I don't think that's the case. Not that we're not still open to everything, but I just don't see anything to indicate that. I think Danny was genuinely, still is, crushed by the loss of his friend. But something doesn't sit right. So something's not making sense because your memory can certainly shift. We've talked about that over and over again, that your memory can be manipulated without you knowing it. Your brain will fill in details and you add things to the story. But when you go to Danny's 91 interview and Dion's 91 interview, you have direct conflicts there as far as who was with them and where they went. And I'll be honest with you, when I first heard that interview, Mike and I listened to it together and started listening. I said, oh, dude, I think this guy's involved.
Okay.
Like, this story isn't making sense. He's adding details that aren't necessary. Something's wrong here. He's changing the story, was the feeling that I got. But then as I look deeper into it, to me, in my opinion, it seems like Dion and Danny in 91 were trying to create a timeline of events to hide something.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like to me. Not to say that's the case. That's just what it seems like to me. But then as I look further into the case and the investigation and their connection to Bill, I don't think it has anything to do with Bill's murder. So my conclusion was exactly what you just said. Right now, my hypothesis is I think that they might have done something else that night.
Okay.
You know, they might have, who knows, bought some drugs. You know, it could have been something as simple as that. You know, it's 91. It's not 2019 where who gives a shit about marijuana. Maybe they went to go buy a bag of weed and they're like, where are you at that night? and they're trying to tell a story that doesn't involve them stopping at a drug dealer's house to get marijuana.
Yeah.
And so the story gets all jumbled up and has nothing to do with Bill's case.
Donna says, are there any witnesses from 3 p.m. onward that can state if Bill was alone or if he seemed to have company in the store?
No, we haven't come across it. I mean, there's a few. Oh, and speaking of which, I want to clear something up. So I missed something. In the, I don't know, this past episode or the week before. It was the week before because we talked about it on the follow-up. Wiley Holt, the guy that said that he came in and bought gas at 8:15. And we were asking, like, could that have changed our timeline? You know, if he's right about that time. And I said, I think he's probably wrong about the time. It doesn't fit with anything. I completely forgot that in episode one, when we were going through the timeline of events, Wiley Holt was the cab driver that came in and bought the $23 on the register at whatever time it was. It was like 7:30, 7:40 or something like that. If you remember me going through, it was like, we have gas and cigarettes purchased at this time, soda pop purchased at this time, gas purchased at this time, and then a cab driver. That cab driver was Wiley Holt.
Okay.
So when they interviewed him, he said, yeah, I went in, it was like 23. He had like the receipt, I think. It was like $23. He bought 20 bucks in gas and a quart of oil, whatever it was. So his time is verified. He absolutely was not there at 8:15. It does not change our timeline. He was there earlier around, I don't remember the time, so I'm not going to guess, but it was before all the relevant events started taking place. But no, I haven't seen or come across any witnesses that said they saw anybody. I take that back. I did come across one where someone said that Bill was talking to a couple of guys that I thought might have been Danny and Dion. But they described one of the guys as being like tall and thin and blonde, and neither of them fit that description. I can't remember which witness that was.
Okay.
But sometime in the evening, earlier again, before all the relevant events, someone did say they came in and saw him talking to someone earlier in the day. But it sounds like he was there alone other than when Danny and Dion were there. No one seems to say, other than Gutierrez, who comes in at 8:05 and sees the guy with the scar and the earring standing along the edge of the counter right by Bill. Other than that, it seems like everybody just saw customers.
Isabel wants to know if you're going to continue your conversation with Danny. Has he agreed to come back on the show? And has he provided any contact information for other people he says were with him that day?
I hope so. I actually haven't spoken to Danny since Sunday, since we put out the episode. I was kind of waiting to hear from him because it seems like he's listening, because he did listen to last week's follow-up, I know, because when I had said that the name he gave me, Jenny's last name, didn't match any of my records, he texted me back with a couple different options for spelling for her name. I still haven't been able to locate her yet, but and I still want to continue to try to locate her, but I was a little concerned he might be a little upset by me putting out the episode where we kind of showed the discrepancies in the story. So I've just been kind of waiting to hear from him. If I don't, then I'll be reaching back out to him once all the dust settles from this, because I do hope that we can go a little further with it.
Jennifer says, if this was a mistaken identity, why is Danny still alive? I know that sounds terrible, but it seems to point back to Bill possibly being the target. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it's a mistaken identity. I don't think that's an option. Meaning, I don't think that Bill was killed because someone thought that he was Danny. Because that there's a whole lot of reasons for that. One, so say, like how does that happen? And think about it. So what, like someone hires someone? The only way would be if someone hired someone to go kill him.
Yeah.
Which seems odd, considering a couple of teenagers. You know, why is someone doing that? But and I say that because Bill and Danny look nothing alike. Bill was tall and skinny, and Danny was much shorter and heavier set than Bill. I mean, the two look nothing alike at all. So anyone that knew them couldn't have mistaken the two for each other. So the only way that could happen would be if someone like hired someone. They're in there for too long. I think it would have been very easy to clear that up. So I think that maybe it's still a possibility that Danny was the target. Although Danny did text me that too. He said, I wasn't into anything that would have caused anybody to want to hurt me. But I mean, that's what he's saying. But say that, for example, that was the case. And that Bill might have been killed because Danny wasn't there, or Bill was trying to protect Danny or something like that. I don't know. But I definitely don't think it was a mistaken identity.
Yeah.
But to her point, yeah, it does seem odd. If the whole point was to kill Danny, then why didn't they go through with that and accomplish that later? But then again, at the same time, I don't necessarily think that the goal was to kill anyone. You know, I think the goal may have been to threaten. The goal may have been to get something out of him somehow. Like Jim said, the conversation escalated. The argument escalated to the point where Bill got shot.
All right, this next one's from Andrea. I'm trying to wrap my head around the killer taking two shots while someone was at the air pump because they could hear the loud noise, walking out, coming face to face with a witness, and continuing to walk away. What does that say about the killer's confidence, lack of reaction or response to being seen, and or potential relationship to the witness? Do you think any of those behaviors play a role in the criminal profiling?
Well, yeah, I think they do. But you know, we need to get Jim back on the show to talk about some of that stuff because we kind of didn't get that far. I read that to be someone who was mature and confident and probably criminally experienced, in my opinion, because a normal person kills someone, it's immediate panic.
Yeah.
That's what I would say, is immediate panic, whether you know internally or externally. There's going to be this panic, meaning whether or not they have any remorse for what they did, but now they know that body on the floor represents life in prison, maybe the electric chair, depending on where you're at. I have to get away from that body now. I've got to get away from it. And that's just a natural reaction. So the fact that this person was able to walk out and still look calm, not run, walk out and see Danny and keep going. Who knows if it's somebody who he recognized, Danny Martinez? Because remember, you're talking about a neighborhood gas station full of regulars. Danny lived right next. Danny Martinez lived right next door to the gas station. So maybe you recognize him. I don't know. But to me, that definitely fits into a profile of a more mature offender who has some level of criminal sophistication or experience, smart enough to know not to look like the guy that just shot someone when he was leaving the store. And that's a forensic countermeasure. If that's what was happening there, it's no different than, it's on a smaller scale, but it's no different than whoever killed Elnora Griffin pulling her car behind the house and putting towels over the windows. It's not permanent concealment. It's temporary concealment. It's buying time. Whoever that profile to, whoever did this, knows they're going to be a suspect and they just need some time to distance themselves and create an alibi. Walking calmly out of that gas station while somebody's outside to me is the same thing. Not necessarily concealment, but again, it's, I need that person standing at the air pump. I need them to not see me and immediately think, oh crap, what did that guy do? He's running out of the gas station. Immediately, I know that guy did something wrong. And so he walks out so that in those first seconds, enough time to get to a car and get the hell out of there, he doesn't want anyone to know that he just committed a crime.
And I don't think the number of shots really matter either. You know, in the questions, he said that there's two shots and there was two shots, but I don't think that there weren't two aimed shots. There weren't two timed shots. You panic, you pull the trigger. Anytime there's an incident like that, if you see a lot of people open fire, they just pull the trigger. They're just pulling the trigger continuously. It's not, you know, I mean, there could have been five shots. Obviously there wasn't, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think that the number two, like, I don't think it was bang, I'm going to watch you for a minute, bang, and then leave.
Well, I agree, but I don't think it probably happened in that quick a succession either, personally, because I do think we're looking at a revolver. I don't know. We didn't really come to a conclusion on that, but I think we both agree it's probably...
Yeah, I think it's quicker than you would expect.
Well, I'm looking at the angles, right? So it's boom. At some point, his whole body shifts before the second shot. So what I'm picturing in my mind is that first shot was aimed. I mean, he shot him right dead center in his chest, mm-hmm. right in his heart, straight across.
Yeah.
You know, so that to me doesn't look like a panic shot. It could have been, but it's that shot and Bill collapses. And it, to me, that second shot leans me more towards that personal cause, the anger.
Okay.
You know, and I'm curious your opinion on it too, but that's what I see. I see the first shot and then a second one just like hit him one more time before, you know, bop. Bop before he gets out of there.
Well, and see, I agree with the second shot, but I don't think I think it's still faster. A body will recoil faster than you believe.
Right.
You know, so if you're shot, it's not like shot and this massive, like, oh, I gotta move. You know,
right.
It's bang, you move, bang, you're shot again.
Right.
And maybe it was with that personal cause, but I honestly think it was just, I have to make sure this person is dead.
Right. And it could have been that too, but I just.
Because now he's seen me.
Right.
So it's two shots to try to make sure he's dead. But I don't think it's necessarily like two shots because I'm pissed at you, or two shots because you're my girlfriend's new lover, or two shots because of anything. You know, I mean, I just think it was countermeasures to make sure that that person is no longer talking.
And you could be right. It's, to me, it seems like if when you shoot somebody, probably from about the distance you and I are sitting apart right now, right square in the middle of their chest, most people have their knowledge of what happens after that from the movies.
Yeah.
From TV. I don't see anyone pulling the trigger like that, middle of the chest, thinking, well, he might not die. I know that. I know from just the, how anatomy works, that with a 22, a shot to the chest, it, depending on what it hits, there's a possibility that could miss the heart.
Yeah.
Not hit the heart. And the guy could maybe die later, but live long enough to say who it is. But most people, I think that the first shot hit him. And I don't think it's real significant, the second shot. But I think that time gap, if it's a revolver, it's either single action or double action. So either it's got to be manually cocked for the second shot, or if it's a double action,
it's got a
pull. Long trigger pull. And so it's boom, boom. So I just think there had to be, if that's the case, in either case, there had to be a decision to make that second shot. As opposed to, say, a semi-automatic, say you've got a Glock 9mm, with it's got damn near a hair trigger,
yeah,
and it's bop, bop, real quick, that's very different to me than the long trigger pull of a revolver, bop, bop, mm-hmm. the second time. I don't know. It could go either way, I think.
Well, and I think that time frame is okay. I guess what I'm saying by time frame is I don't think it was bang, now I'm going to stand over you and bang. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, no, I don't think that either.
So,
no.
So that's why I say that the second shot is really not super significant in my opinion.
Right.
Which is probably totally wrong, but that's fine. But just in my opinion, I don't think
it is. Well, no, it may very well be. I think it's probably somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Because I definitely don't think that it's that other situation you described where he shot Bill's on the ground, he's looking over him and like F you and pops him again.
Yeah.
I think it happened in about that succession. Pop, pop. But I literally have an image in my mind of some guy shooting him, and as he's recoiling and falling, just being like one more bop, because he shoots him, you know, weirdly up here by the collarbone.
And if you guys are not Patreon supporters, you should be, because you can see how many times Bob just shot me in the chest on the video.
Right. yeah. Yeah, you're missing out on all kinds of good time. Yeah, so I don't know. I think that, but as far as the profile goes, to me, and I'm no more of an expert than you are, but to me, the second shot plays towards that personal cause homicide. So if it's just something, for some reason, the guy's panicked or whatever, he's got to shoot him, and it's just a pop, shoots him in the chest, I see that guy running out of there, that, you know, pulling the trigger the second time and the walking out to me. And Jim Clemente may completely disagree. I mean, because he profiled this as a younger offender, basically with the cash register drawer being gone for staging. So who knows? I mean, I could be completely off base, but in my opinion, those are two different things. Of course, the second shot to me supports the idea of it being a personal cause homicide. The walking out calmly tells me mature and more criminally experienced.
Aaron says, the phone call for Jenny. Can you compare numbers? See if they were off by one or two numbers of people involved. She's talking about the phone numbers here and if there's similarities between them.
Right. And you know, the issue is I don't remember if I mentioned this earlier or not, but we don't have phone numbers. They never pulled phone records. So unfortunately, we can't do that.
This one's from Cena. I don't know if this is an option or not, but I was wondering if we could find Jenny by looking through high school records or yearbooks if Danny remembers which school she went to. Maybe she can be found through class reunion groups. It's just a thought.
That's a really good thought, actually, and we've had success with that before. All the way back in season one, I went on classmates.com and found high school yearbooks and scoured through to find people that I needed to talk to. So that's a really good idea, because I think that Danny may have the spelling of the last name wrong of her, but if you're looking at, these are smaller schools, looking through a yearbook and you're looking for a Jenny or a Jennifer with, you know, last name that starts with an H, I bet it'd be pretty easy to find. Yeah. So I mean, I'll try that.
Roxanne says, what if the wrong number voicemail guy was talking about Gina Luna and thought Bill and she were having an affair? Was Gina married at the time? Did she have a boyfriend? I know Bill worked for her so she could spend Easter with her kids. Could the killer be a jealous husband or boyfriend?
Yeah, I think anything's possible. And I thought about that because, so Gina, I've seen her go by three different names in different articles. I think her name was Gloria Jean, And I think she went by Gloria sometimes, Gina sometimes, and Jeannie. I saw one newspaper article where she was listed as Jeannie. So it's possible that they were talking about her. I mean, who knows? I think she was married at the time. But I mean, it would be really just a lot of speculation to say that was the case. I haven't seen any indication in any reports that there was any kind of connection. I think Jeannie or Gina was significantly older than Bill. And according to Danny and the other reports I've seen, Bill had another girlfriend. He had that girl from Gibson City that he was seeing. I haven't seen any kind of indication that anything like that was going on.
I didn't know that Gina Luna's name, her first name was Gina.
Right, because in the reports it's listed as Gloria.
Right, and that's just something I don't think many listeners caught either, because it's something I just found out. So it's interesting when you think about the phone call, the voicemail.
Right.
All right, our last one comes from Mrs. R. I think there was a statement made saying the robbery stopped for 3 or 4 years after the murder. If this is the case, why? Was someone arrested for another type of crime or moved to another state, die, etc.? I think there must be some explanation for this.
So as I've dug deeper into these files and started opening up more and more of the police reports, what I've found during the course of this week is that they didn't stop in 91. There was a list that was put together by an investigator that showed a bunch of similar crimes. And in that list, there was this big gap. But what I found out was that there was a continued streak of these types of robberies at gas stations in the Bloomington area. And one of the people involved in those other robberies was, in fact, implicated in the murder of Bill Little. And that's part of what I'm going to be covering this Sunday in episode 7. So make sure you tune in 2 days to that. We have a few people that were, in fact, implicated in Bill's murder that were investigated. And we're also finally going to hear from the man that was convicted in Bill Little's murder, Mr. Jamie Snow, this Sunday. We're going to start to shift our coverage into the investigation into Jamie Snow and what ultimately led to his conviction. So again, make sure you tune in on Sunday. And before we let you guys go, Zach, you had an amazing interview on Made Us last week. You want to tell people a little bit about that? Because I think this is one that, if you haven't checked out Zach's show, Made Us, this is one to definitely check out, because it had me extremely emotional listening to it.
So last week, episode 39 of Made Us was actually with Michelle Weaver, who happens to be my wife. And I want people to know first and foremost that I didn't have her on the show because she was my wife. I had her on the show because she has a story.
She has an incredible story.
And it's one about not becoming a product of your environment. She grew up in a pretty rough household, and she's really persevered through a lot. And her story is one that everybody needs to hear. And I think that it's one that a lot of people would understand themselves, and a lot of people have gone through it themselves.
It's crazy. I've known Michelle for a long time. I had no idea she had been through that. You'd never know it. And hats off to you as an interviewer, because I've interviewed my wife, and it's hard when you know someone so personally to try to have a conversation without letting that seep in enough to where the listener doesn't get to hear the full picture, because you know how to fill in those gaps. You did a great job with it.
It's hard because I know that I had to ask questions that were going to upset her,
mm-hmm.
but I knew as an interviewer, you have to ask them.
Yeah, and you did, and she answered them, and it is an extremely moving interview. So check out last week's episode, episode 39
yes.
of the Made Us podcast. And again, make sure Sunday you go ahead and tune into our show and listen to season 7, episode 7. And with that being said, I think we're all done. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Zach.
Thank you.
Thanks. See you guys. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Mike Bussing is our executive producer, and all music for the show is created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our Friday Follow-Up logo was created by Amanda Meyer with Willow Photo and Design. And all of our font across all of our logos and banners was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. I want to thank Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Natalie Alicia, Pamela Westby, Pam Maples, and Jen Reese in Candela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels on Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, ad-free versions of all of our episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support the show by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website. Just click on the case submissions button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. And for all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter. The show's handle is @TruthJusticePod, and my personal Twitter handle is @BobRuffTruth. And you can also connect with Mike, @MBussing89. For more personal interactions, feel free to follow me on Instagram, @TruthJusticePod. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice.